From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for June 3rd, 2022. Checking the calendar, it's Pride Fest this weekend. The Scottish Highland Games are on Sunday in Franklin, and your Milwaukee Brewers are home this weekend with the San Diego Padres. Let's start with the Darwin Awards that honor those people who spill chlorine into the gene pool. In a recent study, 6% of Americans think they can beat a grizzly bear in hand-to-hand combat. Besides being stupid, it's also known as thinning the herd. A Las Vegas institution is going away. You big hunk of burning love. You can no longer get married by Elvis. A company that licenses Elvis images has put an end to the roughly 10,000 Elvis weddings a year. Ladies and gentlemen, Elvis has left the building. In Livingston, Montana, if a student rides his horse to school, by law, the principal needs to tend to the horse. Well, 12 graduating seniors rode their horses to school as part of senior prank day. But the principal refused to tend to the animals and broke the state law. Although he was not charged, he at least should have gotten a detention for not playing well with others. And finally, the Seattle couple sold their million-dollar home, packed one suitcase apiece, and are living permanently aboard cruise ships. Well, it cost them about $60,000 annually to maintain their landlubber lifestyle, but their life at sea only costs about half that. The $30,000 includes entertainment, food, transportation, gratuity, port fees, taxes, and of course, seasick pills. Doing the math, they can maintain their cruising lifestyle for 28 years. 28 long years. Even the love boat only lasted 9 seasons. On the podcast today, we have Art Rothschild, Chris Evers, Joel Dreesing, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Max, I'm not sure how many cats reviews and bad buffet food days I could take. Not sure that more than one or two weeks on a cruise ship is more than I can handle. So appreciate, however, maybe the thrift that they're applying to their lives. Well, a week in which thrift probably would have helped. The S&P down 1.2% this week, closing at the bell at 4108. The NASDAQ down 1%, 12,013 at the bell. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average finished the week at 32,899, down 0.9% after falling 349 points today. The Dow was actually up through Thursday with a pretty strong day of returns, but because of the poor Friday, finished the week down. For the week, the yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury moved up 21 basis points, closing at 2.95. Still yet to eclipse that 3% mark that we were dealing with a little earlier this year. I think perhaps in a sign that we see some more moves from the Fed, but that there may be an end in sight if the Fed can get inflation under control. And maybe that's the place we start, Art. You know, I think as we exit the most recent earnings season, we've got maybe another month and a half before we get into another earnings season. We've got a constant drip of economic data, but really the only thing that's left on the horizon near term is, you know, what the Fed does in the June meeting. And then, you know, we're already talking about July and we're already talking about what happens in September. And I think, you know, the reality is that we could be pretty confident about what happens here in June, but the Fed continues to be dependent upon, you know, what's actually going on with the economy. That's good news for investors. I think it will end well as long as the Fed continues to have a little bit of an impact and as they continue to watch, you know, what that impact is. I think the mistake we may be making as investors is in thinking that what they're doing today continues forever, or likewise that they stop too soon.
Yeah, Kyle, you framed the issues of the week, I think, very, very well, and the issues that, you know, we have to look forward to as investors. If I was an individual investor without help, I'd be really frustrated. Our role is to kind of interpret what's going on. And one of the things, there's an old saying on Wall Street, the investors abhor uncertainty. And certainly, as you just suggested, there's a lot of uncertainty. But I think the thing that's most certain in this environment is the Fed and their resolve to combat inflation. There's an article earlier this week by Alan Blinder, former vice chairman of the Federal Reserve, that suggested that something we suggested repeatedly on this show, that it isn't only loose monetary policy, it isn't only low interest rates that have driven inflation higher. It is the war in Ukraine. It is a shortage of materials. It is COVID causing problems with the supply chain. It's the excessive demand, of course, from consumers who've had more money to spend. Those things are not going to go away overnight. But the Fed, although some have criticized them for waiting too long to get started, I think they're doing everything right. As a matter of fact, I think they're communicating very well what they plan to do. Lael Brainard, the vice chairman, the current vice chairman, was on CNBC yesterday saying the same thing that Loretta Mester, president of the Cleveland Fed, said today. I heard it loud and clear. I was sitting at home getting ready for this show. They're going to raise rates 0.5% in June. They're going to raise rates 0.5% in July, you know, read my lips. Now, if something untoward happens or untoward happens that, you know, causes them to hesitate, then we've got a problem. And then the only real question is, what are they going to do in September? And then in September, you know, hopes are up that, oh, maybe they'll stop because inflation will be coming down. Well, that'd be lovely to think that that's going to be the case, but it may not be. It likely won't be. And both of these ladies suggested that it'll be 0.25% if it's not 0.5%. So Fed policy to me is pretty clear. The market's reaction, whether growth stocks are going to do better or value stocks are going to do better or interest rates are going to continue to go higher, you know, I quite frankly don't know what's going to happen next, and that's why we build balanced portfolios. But I'm just glad we're here to, you know, talk people through this, and I'm glad I have you guys to talk to when I have concerns.
Well, and let's be clear, Art, that the risks on the horizon think are pretty properly reflected in how poor stocks have performed this year, also reflective of how poor bonds have performed so far this year. When you look at, you know, what the Fed is doing, first of all, raising interest rates causes you to discount the future value of stocks. And so if you're valuing a high growth stock based on the cash flows you're going to get over the next 10, 15, 20 years, well, you shouldn't be willing to pay a dollar today for a dollar of earnings in the future, but what you are willing to pay is based on what the interest rate is. And if the interest rate goes up, you're willing to pay a little bit less today. And so I think it's clear the market has digested this idea that the Fed is going to continue to push rates higher in an effort to combat inflation. I think it's clear that maybe they were a little late to the game here, and so you're seeing a little more on the front end. You're seeing a little more pain on the front end of what we otherwise would have seen. But the other piece of this that hangs out there is this dreaded R word, right? It's the, well, what if the Fed causes a recession? What if we enter a recession despite the Fed's best efforts? And Chris, you have been talking for quite a while about how significant the consumer's role is in navigating whatever those issues might be. And I think it's clear that the consumers have far more ammunition this time around than they did in, you know, any number of the last times we were talking about recession.
Yeah, Kyle, let's just kind of pull some of these thoughts together really quickly. So I think as Art, you've put together for us, it's pretty clear what direction the Fed's taking here. You know, what's not clear necessarily is what type of impact will that tightening of financial conditions, tightening monetary policy have on aggregate demand, right? And what we mean by that sounds fancy, but essentially means, are consumers going to slow their spending because interest rates go up? And is that going to have the desired effect of lowering inflation, all right? So that's really the question that's out there. Will that impact really impact aggregate demand, the moves that the Feds take? And if that is the case, the question is, well, is it such a decrease in aggregate demand that we move into a recession? Right, and I think everybody becomes fearful of the word recession. You know, I think we're probably still scarred yet from, you know, the great financial crisis as being, you know, even though we had the pandemic recession, probably the most memorable one in a lot of investors and a lot of Americans' lives, they think of that. But when we look at the state of the consumer going into this tightening cycle, the consumer is in such a good shape from the amount of money that they've saved. They're not sitting on homes that they can't afford, that they've taken on liabilities and underwater on the value of their homes. They don't have unbelievable levels of credit card debt that they can't support if labor markets go away from them. And labor markets show that people are making a good living and are being able to support their lifestyle. So you look at the consumer and you say, well, even if we got that dreaded R word of a recession, doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a reprisal of what we saw in 2007, 2008. You know, it could very, very much be very far from that.
Yeah, obviously, as we've said many, many times before, two-thirds of gross domestic product is consumer spending. And so if you're concerned about the direction of growth, the thing you should be most concerned about is the state of consumers. And so if we reasonably believe that consumers are in a better place, if we reasonably believe that you know, consumers are still sitting with fat wallets from the stimulus spending that was taking place, you know, mid-pandemic, that, you know, there's all these benefits of higher markets, of higher home values, of consumers who, or rather, lenders that were requiring higher standards to purchase homes. I think that the typical issues that we were concerned about pre-financial crisis coming through, they're not the same issues that are out there right now.
And I think a great point to this would be an example of the housing market. So let's just take a look at the housing market as an example of we've seen a really quick move up in interest rates, but consumers have still been willing to go out there and purchase homes because the consumers have the ability to do so, right? So interest rates have gone up substantially, but we haven't seen prices come down. What that tells you is the consumer is able to support those higher interest rates. I think that's just a very clean example of what we're talking about here.
And I think we need to be clear, obviously, that home prices have, you know, jump to record levels, that interest rates moving back up certainly put a damper on, you know, maybe some people's enthusiasm for paying those prices. But again, I think that's the intent, right? If we're really talking about how do you get prices back in check, you have to dampen consumers' desires to spend. And you do that by making certain things more expensive. You do that by, you know, trying to get the idea across that we're going to do what it takes to fight inflation. And if that means that it's more expensive to buy a home, if that means that, you know, corporations have to borrow at higher rates to build out, you know, factory lines, well, okay, that's the cost because we're trying to get a handle on demand. We need to be clear, of course, that demand isn't the only issue that's out there, that the Fed has some significant control over that side of it, but you know, our supply has been significantly constrained as well. And if we're talking about, you know, wiring harnesses that come from Ukraine that aren't going to European car manufacturers, or semiconductors that aren't going to those same car manufacturers or phone manufacturers, whatever it is, you know, the issues aren't strictly demand driven.
Yeah, when you look at this time around, and I'm in my 30th year here, it's hard to believe, and over that time period, we've seen significant bear markets. This doesn't feel like a bear market. And the S&P isn't quite there, but it could feel like it. But back in when we had the tech wreck, I've mentioned this before, it was painful. It went on for 2.5 years. People were losing their jobs. Stock market declined. Again, huge numbers for at least two of those years, 2001, I think, 2002. The Great Recession, as you just mentioned, you know, before, was catastrophic. I mean, the entire financial system was on the ropes. Housing prices declined significantly. So this time around, not to mention the pandemic, 2 years ago we had a brief recession. Talk about a short recession. That was like the shortest in history. The quickest market sell-off, the quickest recovery in history. And then all the second-guessing that's been going on with respect to the Fed, did they wait too long? I might argue that they did exactly what they should have done. They made sure the American consumer was fat, happy, wealthy, and wise, and that's why they're going to be spending money, you know, as long as they can. And there's one strength of the American consumer is that they spend money. And since that represents 70% of the economy, the Fed would have a Herculean task to bring down their demand. So I think we have to hope that something happens so that oil prices go down, the war in Ukraine ends. This is wishful thinking at this point. But when you see lumber prices declined by 50% from their peaks, this is a good sign. When you see month-over-month inflation decline, as we're hopefully beginning to see, and you can see these Fed, you know, people talking, I think they know what the numbers are going to be, or they have some expectation that they're going to improve. But they don't want to suggest that they're going to stop until their work is done. So I feel very good about where we are with respect to the Fed and what they're doing. I feel very good with respect to, as you indicated, the strength of the American consumer and property values. The wealth effect is tremendous. So even though we've lost money in the stock market, well, that's just part of the game. And when we do our reviews and we see that people are still ahead from before the pandemic. So if someone's concerned and can't take it, you know, get out of the kitchen. But otherwise, you know, I'm hopeful that, you know, as you've indicated so many times, stocks are cheaper. We're going to make some money going forward. It's just a matter of when.
And it's not really part of the wealth effect, but, you know, one of the things that's going on in the economy that helps make consumers fat, happy, healthy, and wise is jobs. And, you know, we've had indications this week that the job market is still really strong. The Labor Department had a report showing that there are twice as many job openings as there are available workers. That's never been, you know, in 22 years of measuring those sorts of things, that's never happened before. They've had the lowest number of layoffs and discharges in 22 years. They have, you know, we got numbers today that the labor market, the job numbers are still growing, that they added 390,000 jobs, employers did in May. And that's the slowest amount that it's grown in 13 months since April of last year. But it's still growing. We're only 822,000 jobs short of where we were, you know, before the pandemic hit. So there's a lot of good things out there in the labor market, and those are the sorts of things that really encourage consumers. And even though we have consumer confidence report from the conference board this week and consumer sentiment report last week from the University of Michigan, they're showing that consumers are kind of, you know, losing some faith in how things are going to be. There are still signs in those surveys that consumers are still with it enough that they want to keep spending. And even the spending numbers that we see, the consumer spending numbers, the retail numbers, they're still spending money. And what we're seeing is more of a shift, and we've talked about this before, from durable goods that, you know, they needed when they were staying at home during you know, lockdown in the pandemic, to now they're getting out more and they're spending more on services, on vacations rather than cars. So, you know, we're seeing some shifts there that's helping parts of the economy that were hurting more earlier in the pandemic.
Well, and Joel, let's be clear that, you know, the employment picture looks so different now than it did even a couple of years ago that, you know, we lost millions of jobs. We're almost back, you know, based on current rate of job growth. We'll be back in a couple of months. You were quick to point out to me earlier today. But, you know, a lot of the recent growth has come in the areas that were hardest hit. Hospitality and leisure, you know, lost a significant portion of those jobs. Well, hospitality and leisure is one of the areas that's been adding them back real quick since, you know, the early part of last year.
Right. And those are the jobs that are begging for workers, too. Those are the sorts of jobs, you know, on the lower end of the pay scale in a lot of circumstances where, you know, workers who are in those positions see that they've got opportunities to do other things and you know, maybe better themselves financially. And for the economy, that's good.
And perhaps some of that's showing up in, you know, the average hourly earnings numbers, perhaps some of that is showing up in those pay increases. But also, you know, I think if you start to look at, and this is something that you and I have been talking about, Joel, what those month-to-month changes look like, not from a month to last month or month over last year, but what's the rate of change and how is that coming down? You know, we've seen wage growth still at a high level, but coming back down to a more reasonable place. We're seeing, you know, job creation, job addition coming back down to a more, you know, typical level. You know, those are all signs that perhaps what the Fed is doing is working. It just takes time for the system to digest some of that.
That's what we're looking at. Yeah. So construction spending, we had numbers on that this week. Factory orders, we had numbers on that. Those are both slower in April than they were in March, but they're both still growing. They're both, you know, not corrected for inflation. They're both at the highest levels ever. So we're still seeing growth, which is good, but the growth is slowing down, and that is my understanding of what the Fed's trying to do. The wage example is a good one. We had that in the Labor Department report today. It was 5.2% increase in average hourly wages from May to May of last year. Well, that number was 5.5% in March and 5.6% in February.
You know, Art, the conversation regarding stocks tends to go back to, well, look at now they're on sale relative to where they were. And, you know, I think the reality is that given the uncertainty that's out there and given some of what we were talking about earlier, there's no reason why they can't become more on sale. Also, no reason why long term they shouldn't be worth more than what they're worth right now. And so the easy answer there is to say, well, yeah, you might be able to get a little bit better deal, but if you wait around long enough, you're going to look smart either way. The part I'm more interested, though, is all of a sudden bonds are contributing to a balanced portfolio in a way they haven't for the better part of the last 10 years. And so investors, you know, need to understand the role bonds play, but they also need to understand that, you know, looking back over the last 10 years, you got 1.5, 2% from your bonds. Looking forward, you know, high-quality intermediate-term bonds are paying 2.5% or 3%. Well, that's a far bigger contribution to total return than what we've seen. And, you know, I think investors need to remember the role that those bonds play.
Yeah, I think bonds have been the biggest conundrum for investors this year. Your average investor has no idea what's happening with bonds. But statistics are showing that after taking a whole bunch of money out, they're starting to put a whole bunch of money back in. One of the things that I believe we've talked about on the show before, but this idea that you can get 9.65% on an I-bond through Treasury Direct, limited to $10,000 a person, it's a steal. And so individual consumers are buying tons of these bonds because they know it's a good deal. We don't know how long it's going to last. But bonds, as you indicated, are an important part of a balanced portfolio. They provide income. Stability, not so much so this year. And quite frankly, if the yield on the 10-year Treasury goes up another 0.5% from here, those bond investors, even though they're going to be making more, they're going to take another hit. So that's why we've always kept duration low. Cash is a great place for stability, with the handicap the past several years being it didn't pay anything. And so you're losing against inflation. And so one of the things that I think I hope the Fed accomplishes, they tried to do this back in 2018 when they were raising rates. I'd love to see banks be able to pay a decent rate of return so savers can get paid on CDs. You've talked about that on the show. And so, yes, bonds are going to be paying more. Bonds are an important part of a portfolio, but they're a tricky part of a portfolio, you know, in this changing interest rate environment that the Fed is conducting. So a little concern going forward, you're right. They're going to pay better. But we use all three on a regular basis, stocks, bonds, and cash in portfolios.
You know, Chris, we often talk about the stock piece of the portfolio as being kind of this broad asset class with all different types of sectors and growth versus value and large versus small. And in the midst of that, I think we often talk about bonds as if it's this kind of uniform asset class, but there's a lot of nuance in fixed income in bonds as well, right?
Yeah, I think there's an argument to be made that, you know, when you have a bond portfolio as piece of your overall asset plan, that maybe you have some really short duration bonds that cover you for a few years that are very insensitive to interest rates. Then you have, you know, some more intermediate term bonds that, you know, pay you a little bit better in terms of yields and, you know, maybe are a little bit more sensitive to interest rates, but they're not maybe your first source of liquidity as you're looking to sell things down the road. So it's not just a big blank canvas that we say, all right, you own bonds, period. No, there's very, you know, unique areas of the market that we can look at investing in that have different relations to interest rates that are less sensitive or that may add a little bit more interest yield to your portfolio. So, you know, I don't want to paint with too broad of a brushstroke when saying, you know, there's a lot there that's out there for investors and something that can fit their needs for whatever that might be.
And all of a sudden that nuance is more important, right? That for a long time you could say you've got bonds, you're fine. And now it's, well, you've got some of these bonds which are right for this reason and some of these bonds which are right for this reason. And so, you know, like as investors, the more diversity we can add to our portfolio, the more things we can prepare ourselves for, the better situated we're going to be when the kinds of storms we're facing come. And so, you know, again, I think understanding that, you know, these asset classes aren't as uniform as we often talk about is important. Well, thanks for listening. We enjoy doing the program for you. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.